From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. A federal law passed last year requires schools to provide free drinking water at lunchtime. The effort is meant to promote health and fight obesity. Ideally, schools install hydration stations where students fill up reusable bottles with chilled, filtered water. But plenty of schools have to make do with old-fashioned water fountains. Youth Radio's Sarah Cavedo reports that at his high school, where he graduated just last year, few students are lining up to drink.
A couple months before California's new law came into effect, I asked my high school principal, Carmelo Scarlato, what he knew about the mandate to offer free fresh water at lunch.
How aware of SB 1413 are you?
I am not. Excuse me, I am not aware of the bill.
But even after I told him, Scarlato said there are lots of other upgrades that would come before water at our school.
Ventilation, way more important in this building because we have no windows that really open. Repairing leaks to cut down on mold buildup. Those are two major areas that I would put money into before water.
Plus, according to both state and federal law, our lunchroom water fountains put my school in compliance with the new water policies. But in the eyes of most students I spoke to, like my friend Jesse Chen, water fountains are nasty.
I wouldn't want to use it.
Why?
Because it's pretty dirty. There's a, I don't know what's in there, but it's pretty bad.
And she's talking about the one working water fountain in the cafeteria, which is covered in stains and which you practically have to make out with to get a drink. Throughout the school, there are signs above most fountains that tell us to run the water for 30 seconds before drinking. And both the custodian and my principal told me janitors run the fountains every morning for 15 minutes to flush the pipes. Makes you wonder how fresh the water really is. I decided to find out.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, come on in, guys.
That's Darlene Franklin, a researcher at San Francisco State University.
Of course I expect contaminants. I expect microbes on there because so many students, I'm sure, probably put their mouth on there.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. All their hands? You never know.
Franklin gives me a bunch of sterile containers, latex gloves, and disinfectant wipes, and shows me how to collect samples.
So got my two samples from this school and getting some weird looks from people for talking into a microphone myself.
A week later, back in Darlene Franklin's lab, we run one last test. After a few minutes fiddling with the microscope, she and her lab partner, Kimberly Suey, finally see something.
Oh, no, no, there they are, there they are.
Good.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm all excited. This is the best part. You get to see them. I got them. They're beautiful.
Kind of beautiful, if you're into that sort of thing. But more to the point, the little yellow blobs are mostly harmless. They're Micrococcus colonies from a fountain in my school's hallway. It's a skin bacterium that can, under certain conditions, cause pitted feet. Gross, I know, but safe to drink at the levels we found. And anyway, it's not just the bacteria students worry about.
I hear there's tons of lead in the school's main water system, so I try to shy away from that.
In case this guy, Aiden Offerman, is onto something, we also tested my school's water for lead. All the samples were under the 20 parts per billion that would take it out of service under EPA guidelines. So at my school, at least, we're better off drinking from our rundown fountains than hitting the vending machines for quote-unquote juice drinks. But that's a hard sell, given student perceptions like Issa DeFusco's.
If I was very, very thirsty or felt dizzy, I would probably go and drink some, but I avoid it pretty much at all costs. Honestly, a lot of time at school I'm thirsty and I don't drink water.
And kids aren't totally crazy to worry. Researchers have found elevated lead levels in school districts from Philadelphia to Seattle. And with no federal policy requiring schools like mine to test their water, it's hard for thirsty kids to know whether the supply is safe. So until water fountains, like elevators, get little plaques certifying they pass muster, plenty of students won't trust the free fresh water in their school cafeterias, policy or not. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Cavedo.
That story was produced by Youth Radio.
Time now for our latest home video recommendation from critic Bob Mondello. With a new movie version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy opening this week, Bob suggests dusting off the earlier TV version.
At some point in my youth, I must have known the nursery rhyme, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Sailor, Rich Man, Poor Man, Beggar Man, Thief. But since 1979, the instant someone says Tinker Tailor, the next two words that occur to me are Alec Guinness.
I've been reviewing my situation in the last half hour of hell, and I've come to a very grave decision.
In the BBC's six-hour miniseries, Guinness brought deadpan wit to the character of George Smiley, a middle-aged ex-spy who's been forced into retirement and who swears he wants to stay there, though from the way he swears it, you'll guess he doesn't really want to settle down in a cozy little cottage in the Cotswolds.
I shall establish myself as a mild eccentric, discursive, withdrawn, but possessing one or two lovable habits, such as muttering to myself as I bumble along innocent pavements. I shall become an oak of my own generation.
The thing is, his former employers need this particular oak to anchor an investigation that has to stay secret even from its own secret agents. There's a Soviet mole in the highest ranks of British intelligence, and Smiley is brought back to root him out.
It's the oldest question of all, George. Who can spy on the spies?
The miniseries takes its sweet time laying out plot points, a luxury the new movie doesn't have. Happily, that allows Guinness to do some plummy philosophizing, in one instance while interrogating a mute Patrick Stewart, who never gets to show off his own plumminess. Lives are on the line, principles too, but like the John le Carré novel it's based on, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is the antithesis of a James Bond fantasy. No flashy gadgets or heroics, just workaday folks expertly plying their trade, be they undercover agents or understated actors. I'm Bob Mandela.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Police believe hazing may have led to the recent death of a band member at Florida A&M University. Commentator Frank DeFord has been wondering what it will take to end that practice among famous marching bands.
Every now and then, as a journalist, you want to think that you haven't just done a good story, but maybe you've actually brought attention to something that can actually do good. I dared feel that a year ago when I reported a piece for the HBO show Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. The story was about violent hazing in the marching bands at HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. At first, as the producer, Josh Fine, outlined the horrors of what was passed off as merely typical old college hazing, I doubted him. I couldn't believe that the premeditated violence that Josh described could possibly be that brutal, that widespread, and that essentially enabled by the institutions. But then as I interviewed band members at HBCU schools, my disbelief grew into shock as I learned about behavior that was effectively institutional torture. New band members, called crabs, had to face choreographed assaults with 2x4s, belts, baseball bats, beer bottles, suffering literally hundreds of blows from their older compatriots. For example, an Alabama A&M flute player vividly told me about how she'd been attacked time and time again by the older flutist. That's right, even flute players, even women, women battering each other. The victims also admitted that they succumbed to a horrible psychological turnabout, because as painfully injured as they'd been when they were beaten, they themselves willingly became the twisted assailants the next year. And so the brutality continued, validated as a way of building band camaraderie. And so the excuses continued, because HBCU bands are the headliners, literally more popular than the football teams that they play for at halftime. The band director at Florida A&M, Julian White, responded to my report by saying that I was just a prejudiced outsider who, quote, made it seem like black schools are the only places where it's happening. That's just not the case. I'm sorry, but that is precisely the case. It is the culture. So extreme has been the band torture at HBCU schools that some victims have had to be hospitalized. After one crab at Southern University almost died when his kidneys stopped functioning, his assailants were criminally prosecuted because, an assistant DA told me, to continue that cycle, somebody was going to die. Still, when my piece aired, there were no apologies, and worse, no change in the way things had always been. The bands must play on. Then last month, a member of Julian White's Florida A&M band allegedly died of beatings at the hands of his comrades in the line of tradition. Julian White has been fired at Florida A&M, but perhaps now they won't just call this sort of thing hazing anymore, anywhere.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each week from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. European leaders are fuming after the ratings agency Standard & Poor's said it may downgrade the credit of countries that use the euro, including France and Germany, which now have AAA ratings. Over the summer, S&P downgraded U.S. Treasury bonds, long seen as one of the safest investments in the world. Now, some analysts are asking whether these days any investment is really risk-free. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
A AAA rating on a security basically is supposed to mean that it has no risk, or virtually no risk. You invest in it and you won't lose your money. That's the theory. But in the recent subprime mortgage debacle, these ratings were spectacularly wrong.
Well, we've learned during the financial crisis that there's a lot of risk in AAA ratings.
That's Felix Salmon, a financial blogger with Reuters. He does not like AAA ratings, and this latest round of financial problems in Europe, for him, underscores why. The problem, he says, is that the AAA rating is kind of a myth. The world is not a perfect place, and every investment must have some element of risk. So why pretend that it doesn't?
So the problem with the AAA rating is that it basically makes people brain dead. AAA is what caused the financial crisis.
Okay, it might not be the only thing that caused the financial crisis, but Salmon says it makes investors lazy and sloppy. And so he'd like to move all ratings a rung lower from AAA down to what's called AA or AA+.
AA plus doesn't carry the same connotations that AAA does. No one will look at a AA plus and say, that's risk-free.
Now, here's where Salmon starts to sound a little bit like he's making the same argument as the guitar player Nigel in the spoof rock band movie This Is Spinal Tap.
This is a top to, what we use on stage. But
in the movie, Nigel's being interviewed about his guitar amplifier, where the little volume knobs are labeled on a scale of 1 to 11 instead of 1 to 10 like most amps.
Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11,
the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10, one louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
The point being that if you call the top rating AAA or AA, what's really the difference? Salmon says there would be one, but some professional money managers are unconvinced.
It's silly to call for the abolition of the AAA rating.
David Kotak is the top investment officer at Cumberland Advisors, and he spoke to us just before hopping on a plane to Europe to go meet with officials there to get the latest on the emerging sovereign debt plan.
We need a AAA rating. We need a AA rating. We need a single A rating. We need a scale. We need a system. The rating agencies made a mess out of that, and now they're in the process of trying to fix it.
Kotak says even right now, amidst all the global financial turmoil, there are institutions that deserve a AAA rating.
Yale University is a AAA credit. It has a huge endowment. There are very sound AAA credits. The probability of default is near zero.
But at the moment, big, powerful nations are not looking like such risk-free investments. John Chambers is chairman of the Sovereign Ratings Group for Standard & Poor's, or S&P.
Well, I think it's a valid question whether government securities are a AAA asset class. We have 20 ratings between AAA and D, and we try to, call the increments as we see them.
As far as whether European nations can protect their current credit ratings by coming to an agreement to stabilize the financial troubles there...
Well, we have hopes, and we... if we had no hope, we would have, lowered the ratings outright.
So the message seems to be clear to European leaders. Hammer out a financial crisis plan or face having your country's debt downgraded by S&P. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The climate treaty talks in Durban, South Africa, are finding mostly disagreements. In addition to the usual divides between rich and poor, north and south, there is no consensus on how to move forward to reduce greenhouse gases. Despite that, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the delegates to press on. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Durban.
Ban admitted up front that a comprehensive deal may well be out of reach in Durban, but that's not reason to give up.
Yes, we all recognize the realities of our time, the economic crisis, the dictates of fiscal austerity, often difficult domestic politics. Yet the world and its people cannot accept no for an answer in Durban.
Getting to yes, though, doesn't just depend on economic conditions. There's also a fundamental rift between nations. 14 years ago, in Kyoto, nations attempted to create a treaty from the top down, in which the international community collectively set the targets for reducing emissions. That paradigm mostly failed. It has largely been replaced with a new approach, which emerged from the Copenhagen talks 2 years ago.
In a way, we're sort of turning the Kyoto model on its head.
Elliot Derringer is from a nonprofit once known as the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, but is now the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. He says many countries in Copenhagen reluctantly accepted an approach in which individual nations would figure out for themselves what they can achieve and then pledge to work toward those goals with no consequences other than scorn if they fall short.
Once we have sorted out at home what we're prepared to do, then it's much easier to bring that into the international context and commit ourselves to that in a binding fashion.
But right now, not everyone shares the desire to turn this arrangement back into a binding international treaty. So it remains a catalog of voluntary actions. And Derringer says many nations still bridle at the system that has largely replaced the Kyoto Treaty.
It's difficult for people to give up what we thought was the answer and envision a path toward a new answer.
One problem is the new voluntary pledges don't come anywhere close to cutting carbon dioxide emissions enough to stop global warming. Bill Hare from a nonprofit called Climate Analytics in Berlin says the pledges made last year in Cancun put the world on a track to blow through the internationally agreed upon goal of limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius.
We're heading to well over 3 degrees. We estimate 3.5 degrees if the Cancun pledges are fully implemented completely. If not, then we're heading for much higher levels of warming.
And Hare says reaching those goals is proving to be a stretch. The United States, for instance, hasn't laid out a clear plan for its pledge to reduce emissions 17% from 2005 levels by the end of the decade. And right now, it does not appear to be on track to meet it.
The U.S. is not alone in that context. What we see from emission trends in many countries is, at the very best, countries are slow to introduce the policies to meet their pledges.
And some of those pledges, such as China's, aren't even to reduce emissions, but just to slow the rate of increase a bit. Yet the world's major emitters have said they are not planning to consider more ambitious pledges just yet. Having a legally binding treaty wouldn't solve that problem, but Jennifer Haverkamp from the Environmental Defense Fund argues that it is important to maintain some sort of credible international forum, and that's a potential victim in the battle here over a future treaty.
It's no accident that Australia passed a climate law right before this set of meetings. It's no accident that South Africa came out with a climate policy just a few weeks ago. So this process is still important for catalyzing and encouraging those activities by countries, but we can't put all our eggs in this basket.
Environmental groups realize a lot of the action is now at the state and even local levels, and action, after all, is what counts in the end. So groups are putting additional efforts there, figuring that if there is success at the smaller scales, that will encourage national governments to make bigger commitments if they ever do decide to move back into a legally binding international deal. Richard Harris, NPR News, Durban, South Africa.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. An SAT cheating scandal in Long Island is prompting calls for tougher security on college admissions tests across the country. Students and educators in the posh North Shore suburbs of New York City say cheating on the SAT is rare, but they also say it's not all that surprising, considering the enormous pressure kids face to do well on the test. NPR's Joel Rose has our story.
It's well after noon on a Saturday when the kids spill out onto the steps and well-manicured lawn of Great Neck North High School. After sitting for the SAT for close to 4 hours, they seem relieved and maybe a little dazed.
It was pretty hard. Towards the end, it got really difficult. The last few questions on each section were hard.
It was all right. Just the math section was a little harder than I expected, harder than I practiced.
Mario Stefanidis and Samuel Yim are both 16. Stefanidis goes to high school in Queens, while Yim goes to Great Neck South. Yim says there's a lot of pressure to do well on this test.
Well, my mom pressures me to get high scores like 22s and 23s, and I don't know if I can achieve them, so.
Yim says he would never cheat, but he's heard of other kids who did, even before the scandal in Great Neck broke in September. So has Ali Grammy, a senior from Queens.
I heard of people, like, taking the test and, like, pretending to be someone else. Like, my brother has a friend that took the SAT, and he took it for another person for money.
They want that bumper sticker on the back of their car that says a certain thing, and you need a certain score in order to get into that school.
Jill Maddenberg is an independent college counselor who works with kids from Great Neck and other Long Island towns. She compares cheating on the SAT to using illegal drugs.
Kids know that that is an option available to them, and if they want to pursue it, they can. Most of them do not. Most of them don't want to go down that path, but they know it's an option if they want it. And, you know, that's just a sad reality.
The Nassau County District Attorney acknowledged as much when she announced charges against 20 current and former students. A few are charged with impersonating other students for money, most with paying someone else to take the test for them. At a New York State Senate hearing in October, Great Neck North Principal Bernard Kaplan was quick to blame the Educational Testing Service, or ETS, the company that administers the SAT.
ETS has made it very easy to cheat, very difficult to get caught, and has failed completely to include homeschools in the process.
Kaplan and others want ETS to require students to take the test at their own schools to minimize the opportunity for impersonation. But ETS says that would be impractical and potentially unfair to students at smaller schools that can't afford to give the test as often. And ETS spokesman Tom Ewing insists the company already does a good job of catching cheaters.
If somebody is determined enough to cheat to the point where they will create fraudulent IDs or hire somebody for $1,000 to take the test. I mean, we're not going to be able to catch them all, but we believe that we catch the vast majority of them.
The College Board, which owns the SAT, is looking at ways to improve test security. In the meantime, educators hope the Long Island scandal leads to more consideration of the enormous pressure facing high school kids. Sam Frank is the Great Neck site director for Test Takers, a private SAT prep company.
For these kids, it can be really, really tough. They have tons of classes, they have sports, and they have to put SAT prep on top of all that because that's what it takes.
Educators say college admissions officers could help too by placing less emphasis on standardized test scores or making them optional. But with college applications at record levels and climbing, that's likely to be a tough sell. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.